This video is a pretty blunt discussion about suicide, and to talk about suicide so openly poses a risk, but to not talk about it so openly also poses a risk. That said, if you don't feel sure about hearing any of this stuff, I would not recommend this video. I realized today that it's been 2 years since I lost a mate of mine. Used to be one of my closest mates to suicide. And it's weird, before making this video, I was kind of going through a similar headspace that I was just before I got the news of his death, which was sort of similar to maybe a creative block. And that all evaporated after he died. But yeah, my head's a little empty at the moment. So I wanted to make a video tribute, but I didn't know what to say. And then I remembered that I'd written it all down. Actually, it is the exact words that I start this book with. Introduction, some thoughts on suicide and the weather. This is what I wrote in the aftermath of his death. Suicide is a terrible place to start a book. You might be inclined to put it down now, and I might be inclined to draw a parallel between suicide and deciding to quit something you've only just begun. But I wouldn't, because that would be tasteless, and you wouldn't, because you ought to get your money's worth. And besides, one of the tiny little demons in your soul has an insatiable appetite for all things morbid and grim. And that dark demon wants to know where all this suicide chat is going. Suicide is self-destruction in its final form, the perfect opposite of creativity. Yet, despite being opposing forces, self-destructive tendencies and creative flair go hand in hand. To write about creativity and ignore the monster is to not write about creativity at all. The era currently unfolding is one of extremes. We have unprecedented access to information and new ideas, yet also a mental health crisis of staggering proportions. As technology makes life more comfortable and convenient, rates of anxiety and loneliness paradoxically soar. Why is it that what seems like a societal bloom makes so many of us feel unforeseen doom? And what can we do about it? Does modern life have you feeling increasingly overwhelmed, terrified, angry, disappointed, nihilistic, confused, left behind, left out, tapped out, or lonely? You're not alone. I know what it feels like to suffocate in doom, to self-medicate to the point of addiction, and rack up endless hours on Reddit while my bigger screen fills the remaining gaps of silence with YouTubers yapping about aliens and chess drama, to desperately consume the spectrum of solutions from convoluted psychological papers with titles the length of paragraphs to patronizing self-help podcasts that say things like, all you have to do is breathe and believe. But I also know the other side, what it feels like to live in a state of wonder, curiosity, joy, love, and sublime creativity, to feel flow so divine you can't help but grin, to be struck by lightning on a bus seat, to bawl at a cheesy pop song because Carly Rae Jepsen sounds so damn happy, and to have your messiest problems solved in a sudden rush of clarity prompted by a single sentence hidden on the 89th page of an old, neglected library book. On that note of positivity, let's talk about suicide. I've wrestled with suicidal ideation for most of my life. When I was 17, I gave it a shot. If suicide attempts had critics the way movies do, a critic might call this one over the top. I drove my mum's Honda Odyssey into a tree. No subtlety, that movie critic would write. The crash itself, bloated and verbose, still manages to be painfully anticlimactic. Not only does he destroy his mother's car and survive, but it's as if he learns nothing. Any gratitude you'd hope the protagonist might feel for having survived the wreck is sorely missing. The most suicidal aspect of Campbell's entire attempt will inevitably be the audience as they search for something better to do with their time. Not to ruin the ending, but I survived. We're taught that suicidal ideas are extreme, fringe, abnormal, ill, selfish, taboo, uncomfortable, uncommon, fake, ungrateful, romantic, toxic, indulgent, ignorant, insane, and wrong. This seems like a lot of baggage to place on what seems like a lot of baggage. Perhaps the idea is that judgment will act like a deterrent. The logic, I guess, is that being labeled attention-seeking will make killing yourself embarrassing? Or maybe it's an honest attempt at a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we pretend suicidal thoughts are rare, then suicide itself will become rare. Or perhaps it's more superstitious, like stories of monsters summoned by the mention of their name. If we say suicide 5 times in a mirror, will it suddenly appear like Candyman? Or will we just make a profoundly isolating experience feel even lonelier? When someone dies from suicide, it's as if their pain is redistributed from their soul to all the people who'll miss them. The misery, victorious to a fault, finds new company in us. We, who'll forever regret not making that call to catch up, who'll replay countless conversations as though we had the power to change them, who'll keep their name and number in our phones and accidentally scroll past them on our way to someone else. We, who'll spend the rest of our lives wondering what we could have said to make them stay. If you've ever lost someone to suicide, which sadly applies to more and more of us these days, you'll know the torture of the aftermath. You'll know the shock, anger, confusion, regret, fatigue, and that the phrase, time heals all wounds, is at best a bumper sticker. I loved my friend Tin Man, whose real name will leave in peace. We were close friends, best friends at times, for 12 years. His funeral was confusing. His family, his playlist, and the friends of his I'd only ever see at birthdays and weddings, they were all there. My mind knew these things to mean Tin Man, so I kept expecting him to show up and say, gotcha! But instead, Tin Man was dead and would stay dead for the rest of my life, despite whatever divine bargains my brain pretended were real. Seeing his mum outlive him broke my heart. I hugged her like she was my own mum and wept. You're crying more than me now, she said, laughing sincerely. She laughed because if she cried, she'd have to cry for all of it. I only had to cry for 12 years of friendship. She'd have to cry for losing her perfect baby, and for all the memories of cuddling a toddler in bed, for his first day of school with a backpack twice his size, for Christmases, for birthdays, for the terrifying teenage years, the drum kit, the guitar, the eyebrow piercing that definitely wasn't a phase, the rock climbing wedges he installed throughout the house, for coffees and crosswords, and for the man her son became, and for every tiny detail in between. Then she'd have to cry for all the things she wished had gone a different way. So of course, she laughed. All these people, she gestured, and everyone Tin Man had known, all their lives were made better by my son. It's true. Tin Man made my life better. But not all the time. There were times he talked too much on road trips, times he made it hard to help him, and times he didn't deserve the aux cord. But that's the deal with friendship. If you want a friend to change your life, you've got to let him in. Not just when they're a well-oiled machine, but when they're down a heart and calcified in rust. And hopefully, you can tell them that you love the rust too. Tin Man was as full of pain as he was spark. The pain had him convinced that the world only cared about the spark. It had him believe that if anyone ever saw the pain, they'd have undeniable proof of his worthlessness and reject him on the spot. So, to ensure that this never happened, he made the spark as big as humanly possible. He lit up rooms like a walking sun. He was bright, warm, and always welcoming. Yet, he somehow found a way to make sure no one ever stared at him directly. This is to say, Tin Man was the most charismatic person I've ever met. I know you might have some skepticism hearing that because, of course, I'd talk about my dead friend in a nice light. I have to, right? But this isn't a posthumous observation. I, like everyone he'd ever met, had been saying this for years. He was charm incarnate. To make matters worse, he was frustratingly handsome. The bastard even had the audacity to play every instrument under the sun, have a mental library of well-crafted stories, drive a cool car, crack vibe-appropriate jokes, and, it pains me to report, he was also shredded. Tin Man was the first person I knew to do CrossFit, and oh my god, did he go on about it? All these qualities, minus the gym preach, made him a magnet for women. Tin Man was broken, so he treated this love like a drug. The more he got, the more he wanted, the worse he became. There were times when this was unbearable to witness as a friend. He'd destroy a relationship with a woman he truly loved, start three more the next day, and continue the other two relationships he'd kept in secret for months. He was horrible, in this sense. But I struggle to judge him as harshly as I perhaps ought to, because to me, it was clear his behavior was a symptom. For reasons I may never know, I did stare directly at the sun that was Tin Man. And for reasons I'll definitely never know, he let me. Instead of burning my retinas, there was a black hole at the center of his soul that had been there since childhood. The kind of wound that happens far more than society would like to admit, and a wound that I share, one that set in motion a life of misery masked by adventure. He never recovered, he just kept moving, but this curse caught up with him, as formative horrors so often sadly do. Tin Man's main coping strategy for the pain that plagued him was to block it out. He projected the idea that his life was perfect, as if doing so would make it so. But this mask dropped every time he made stuff. One time, our band played a gig on Halloween, and we dressed up as the characters from The Wizard of Oz. Tin Man, of course. Pick the Tin Man. Dressed as a guy who had no heart, singing songs about his own numbness, Tin Man let it all out. Through art, he was able to express himself truthfully, and in doing so, he felt fulfilled. Something about creating songs allowed him to drop his guard. We've all had times when we felt our spark fade. When happiness seems out of reach by miles or millimeters, the natural response is to adapt and keep on living. We lug around invisible weights, go through the motion of our day, smile, wave, and wonder if this is as good as it gets. The longer we live in this state of slow erosion, the more it feels like the only state there is. Sometimes we need a miracle to snap us out of it. Other times it takes a tragedy. And sometimes the sudden clarity can shock you into writing an entire book. I delayed writing this book for 2 years while I discovered just how urgent laundry and dirty dishes can become. After my first book was published, I tried to write another before becoming a dad. I did, but I didn't like the manuscript enough to submit it. Then my wife and I had our hands full, falling madly in love with our daughter. Instead of making stuff, I engaged in a whole lot of not making stuff. At first it felt harmless, as though I was just creating a little less. Then I stopped drawing altogether. Big deal, I thought. But this invalidating attitude wasn't quite enough to sabotage my craft. I also had to hate myself. Thankfully, I'd had plenty of practice. My 10,000 hours of self-flagellation made for a seamless transition into an unremarkable depression. The not-so-seamless transition out of this sadness came with a phone call. Hey, Cam. It was Tin Man's brother. When a friend's brother calls you out of the blue on a Saturday night, you pray it's for a poorly organized surprise party. Bit of bad news. My first thought was that Tin Man was in hospital. Before I had a second thought, he told me that Tin Man had died a few hours ago in a self-induced car crash. A few days later, Tin Man's brother asked me to create some artwork for the funeral. I felt honored, which was much nicer than anything else I'd felt recently. Without thinking, I was drawing again. I drew an artwork, dense, with references to Tin Man's life. Every time I finished a section, I felt an urge to photograph it and send it to Tin Man because I kept thinking about how much he'd love it. Every time it took a second before I remember he was meant to be dead. And then another second before I realized he actually was. My brain had added a step in where we were all pretending, rehearsing for a tragedy, instead of being stuck in one. Lost for what to make of it all, I just kept on drawing. If, after suicide, one person's pain is redistributed in pieces to their friends and family, the joy that person brought to the world does something similar. The inspiration, the spark, the wonder, the brilliance, it also needs a new home. And there's no one more deserving than the people who loved its former host. All their qualities, like pollen floating in the ether, make their way to you. Tiny happy seeds get planted in your soul and start to grow. Drawing this picture of my friend, who I'd loved for years, I was struck by this feeling. Tin Man was someone who I'd created countless projects with, spent endless hours in the flow state with, and here I was again, back in that creative realm. He hadn't left. He just shirked the pain. Doom had already made itself at home, but bloom was still within reach. The key is creativity. Not the arts, but creativity, the opposite of destruction, the thing that connects the dots and lets your mind go free. I'm not just talking about making things that are overtly recognized as creative, like albums and sculptures, but the ability to create anything. Meals, jokes, friendships, babies, money, sweet gains at the Iron Cathedral. Most of the things that make life rich are generative processes. And yet, creativity is often talked about as though it's some rare mystical birthright, available only to a fraction of the population. Creativity unlocks potential in all areas of life, not just artistic endeavors. Generative mental habits can spot financial opportunities. Lateral thinking can solve a fitness goal. And the flow state serves as a remarkable antidote to the angst that haunts our species. Not to mention the angst multipliers that plague our time. The aim is to make the creative state accessible, additive, and fulfilling, even if it seems like you're in the pits of hell. In the bluntest way possible, if you're feeling like absolute dog shit, the purpose of this book is to get you creating stuff. Not necessarily for the sake of producing any specific output, but for the headspace it puts you in. My aim with this book is to stop another crash. One reason I'm writing this book is to help heal me. I hope, or more accurately, I suspect that it will. And I suspect, or more accurately, I hope that reading these words will help you too. I hope that through this book, you find a way to treat your creativity naturally with love so that it stays with you and you stay with it. And through that process, you don't destroy yourself, but instead you bloom. And that's, yeah, what I wrote shortly after he died. Anyway, just wanted to share that. That's all. Have a beautiful day. Catch ya.